Right. Do I have a point where I can't walk forward without there being like...
Oh, yeah. There's that speaker right behind you.
Okay.
So what we could do is just kind of move you over here.
Okay, so don't walk over there. Gotcha. Yeah, Doc had that same problem, didn't he? No. Yeah, has Doc told you his theory on why he is godlier than everyone else? Yeah, he said that, you know, he has no trace of Nephilim blood in him because yeah. So in his mind, I also in his mind too, if you've the book of Revelation, the new heaven coming down a new Jerusalem, he says that's really New Jersey. In the Vedic manuscripts. All right. Will you guys please join me in some prayer? Father, in Jesus' precious name, we thank you so much for this opportunity. Thank you that we can come here and learn more about you and your kingdom and how to defend your faith. We love you, Lord. We pray this in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. So real quick, before I get going, my name is Matt. I work with Doc. I'm actually the vice president of the Institute of Biblical Defense, which is an apologetics, specifically really philosophical apologetics is where our real strong point is. I'm also on staff with him at Trinity Bible Fellowship. Christ saved me when I was 17 years old. I was going to a Baptist church, and my pastor constantly preaching the gospel. Got to the point where I trusted in Jesus Christ alone for salvation. And then I realized I wanted to go into the ministry. So I went to the place where my pastor had gone to school, Liberty University, for my undergrad degree. Then I came back, and during that, I met Dr. Fernandez. And it was funny, the first time I ever heard him speak, he was teaching like how to teach the gospel at the camp I was working at. And I remember like I see him, and he goes and starts talking. I was like, who is this guy? I mean, who talks like that? And then all of a sudden I was like, oh wow, he's kind of smart. And then I was like, yeah. And I was like, my gosh, this guy's brilliant. And then after he was done talking, I went up to him and we ended up talking for like an hour. And it was kind of one of those things too. Even then, I was still not very skilled in philosophy. But we started talking, and people would come up, and then they would just kind of be like, huh? And then they would kind of be like, what are you? And then they would leave. But we had a really good talk, and then he was the first one actually to encourage me to go into apologetics and suggested the master's degree in philosophy and religion and ethics from Talbot School of Theology, which is part of Biola. And there it was pretty cool. I got to study under William Lane Craig, Doug Geivitz, J.P. Moreland, I mean, just brilliant, brilliant philosophers. And then after that, I came back, started working at the institute in the church, and then finally I wanted to start my Ph.D. So I applied for a Ph.D. in apologetics and theology from Liberty University. And it's Gary Habermas, that's kind of like his program. And so I've been working on that, and it is pretty cool. So, that's my basic rundown. Today I'm going to be talking to you guys about current trends in atheism. Essentially, this talk is going to be broken up into three sections. Four if you count the Q&A. The first one is I'm going to be defining and describing the new atheism. The second section is I'm going to be talking about the role or importance of evidence. And number three, I'm going to give you actual objections and responses that I have had. So my whole goal for this is to present a very practical and pragmatic way to defend the gospel or to defend Christianity against this newer form of atheism. And then finally, I want to do this for about an hour and then leave about 30 minutes for a question and answer, because I'm sure a lot of you have been like, well, I have this objection come up all the time, you know, like what you were talking about in the last one, you know, I commonly hear this. I'm trying to give you guys all the common objections I give you at the end, these are the things that I constantly come across. And so I'm trying to give you guys a heads up and tell you what they are, and then tell you also how you deal with it once you receive it. By the way, I'm nowhere near as smart as this talk might seem that I am. It's because 80% of this is Dr. Fernandez's. So if you think I was like, wow, this guy's really smart, and then you go and you read a couple of Doc's books and be like, dude, he's a copier, man. He's just stealing that stuff. So yeah, it's my mentor. So obviously, you know, no one's gonna say, oh, Plato, he totally stole from Socrates. And I was like, no, he's a student. It's allowed to. So I try and quote him when I can, but luckily for me, I've studied under him so much and I know his thoughts so well that it kind of feels like my own. And but anyways, so let's do this. So start off the new atheism. Now, the new atheism is primarily composed of four leaders, which are known as the Four Horsemen. Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Christopher Hitchens. I'm not really going to go into any of them specifically, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to examine six of their main points, and in that I might talk about some of them specifically, but I want to talk about these main points, stuff that you will constantly hear them say, and then I'm going to give you general responses to them. The first one is, this is what they would argue, faith and reason cannot coincide. Number one thing that they will say is faith and reason cannot coincide. Now, this is actually a pretty funny story. Richard Dawkins was debating, it was Lennox from Oxford, and that was one of the points. You got two Oxford guys going against each other in a debate. Dawkins isn't at Oxford anymore. But they're going at their debate, and Dawkins says, you know, faith and reason are incompatible. They do not work together at all. And Lennox goes, but Richard, you have reason that your wife is faithful to you. And he says, well, of course I do. And then he's like, well, you just said that reason and faith can't coexist. But you just said that you have reason to believe that your wife is faithful to you. So all of a sudden, it was funny because he didn't get it, and then he kind of got really embarrassed afterwards. By the way, if you guys aren't really up on some... I just found out about this when I was at school, so I didn't know about it. But for a long time... Well, I knew about this, but for a long time, William Lane Craig, one of the leading Christian apologists and scholars, has been wanting to debate Dawkins. And Dawkins has been, you know, dogging him, and he's like, who's this Mr. Craig guy? Why should I let him pad his resume by debating me? And he's turned down like five debates with him. Anyways, at Cambridge this fall, they're setting up a debate, and they're calling it the open chair debate. Go and Google, look at YouTube for open chair debate, and there's a really cool like 8-minute video on there talking about this debate. And basically, it's William Lane Craig is going to be at this debate, and there's going to be two chairs, and he's going to be there. And if Dawkins doesn't show up for the debate, he's just going to do a lecture on how he's wrong in these areas. But it's interesting because, you know, Dawkins has made all these boastful statements saying, you're like, we'll have a great conversation, and you'll be proved wrong. No one has shown me how my argumentation is wrong or any of these things. And William Lane Craig is like, no, you're wrong in these areas. In these areas, why don't you debate me? But you know, the thing is Dawkins isn't a fool. He knows that William Lane Craig has crushed almost every major atheist philosopher out there. The only times he doesn't do too well in a debate, we were talking about this earlier, is he gets super, super smart on everybody. I mean, for my class, it was a one-week class. We had to read like 3,000 pages and like three of Einstein's books. And I was like, whoa, I'm like trying to do philosophy of religion here. If I wanted to read a physics book, I would have been a physicist. But anyways, so check that out. Very, really interesting debate. Getting back to it. So what is the role of faith and reason? How do we respond to this? One of the things that I will say is reason tells us the things that we should have faith in. Reason tells us the things that we should have faith in. And one of the ways I best know how to describe faith is I simply just say it's trust. If you want to understand what faith is, the best way to understand it is that it's a synonym for trust. So I use my reason to know what I should trust in. A lot of the times I am charged with saying, oh, you're just, you know, you're believing these things on faith. You're believing these things on faith. And I'm like, no, absolutely I'm not. I think the two greatest doctrines there are in all of Scripture are creation and the resurrection. Now, both of these, I would say, I utilize no aspect of faith in my knowledge of them. The reason why I can say God created the universe is there is an obscene amount of evidence. There's philosophical, besides the philosophical cosmological argument, there's other cosmological arguments. So many arguments. The same thing for the resurrection. The resurrection, you have internal evidence, external evidence. All these things I believe in are based on reason. Now, where faith comes in is where Jesus says, hey, listen, when I have been raised up, I'm going to draw all men to myself. Faith comes in when I say, man, can I apply that to myself? Is it true? Is it true that Jesus can forgive me of these sins? That's where faith comes in. Faith comes in as an aspect of trust. Can I trust it? My reason tells me that this is solid, but will I take that step where I'm actually trusting in it? So that's really how I think the best way to describe the difference between reason and faith. But they most definitely can coincide. Anybody that says reason and faith are incompatible, I'd say, you know, you really don't know what you're talking about. You got to kind of say it in a nice way. All right, the second thing is religion, or specifically Christianity, is anti-intellectual. A lot of times, how many of you guys have come across something like this? You know, I come across this, I get a lot. A quotation I get a lot, too, is by Luther. And this quotation says, reason is the greatest enemy faith has. And I say, whoa! Oh my gosh! What about the rest of the quotation? And they're like, what? Like, you know, there's more to that quotation. He didn't just write a book, and that was the whole title of it. No. Here's the rest of the quotation. Reason is the greatest enemy of faith has. And then here's what it goes on to say. It never comes to the aid of spiritual things, but more frequently than not, struggles against the divine word, treating with contempt all that animates from God. So all of a sudden he's realized what the context of this is saying is, he's like, listen, human wisdom next to God's wisdom is an enemy. Even if you're the most staunch atheist, you could say to him, well, listen, if God did exist, don't you think that he would have a more privileged perspective on things? Well, yeah. So then wouldn't you say then his wisdom would be stronger than that of a human wisdom? Yeah. Well, so then what's wrong with his statement? So, and I was like, too, have you ever read Luther? He loves reason. He loves wisdom. Why would you write all these books and these arguments for justification and faith and then say, oh, but by the way, I wrote all these volumes here, but I don't like reason, so I'm just going to leave this over here. It's like, no. He said, the best way I know how I explain this to people is this. If God tells you to do something, no matter what you decide in your head, you should not talk your way out of it. Like, for example, if God says to me, Matt, I want you to sell your car and, you know, give it to the poor and buy a bike. You ride around. Now, if I knew that is from God, there should be no amount of reasoning that I can do to dissuade myself of that. I shouldn't be like, well, you know, God really doesn't want me to get rid of my car because it's cool. You know, I have a Jeep. It's awesome. I drove up here with the top off. I thought it was going to be sunny, but luckily it didn't start raining. But so, yeah, there's no amount of human reason that should be able to dissuade me of what I know God has told me. So in that sense, yeah, reason is the enemy of faith. All right. Now, I'm going to say something here, and I'll explain it afterwards. But it is a sin to be anti-intellectual. It is a sin to be anti-intellectual. Now, I'm not trying to say that we all need to be like scholars like Dr. Fernandez. I'm not saying that at all. You know, sometimes I hear him talk and, you know, I don't hear him talk for a while and I'm thinking, yeah, dude, I'm starting to get to the level of Doc and understanding these things. And then he talks and I'm like, man, I got a while to go. But we need to love knowledge and we need to love wisdom and we need to love truth. It is, I don't want to say impossible, because I very rarely use those absolute statements, but I would say it's almost impossible for someone to be a Christian who doesn't absolutely love truth. And the reason why I say that is, Jesus refers to himself as the incarnation of truth. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made through him, and without him, nothing was made that was made. In him was the light, and the light was the light of men. Light shines in the darkness, and the darkness could not comprehend it. And then it goes on later and says, and the Word became flesh, and it dwelt among us. Well, that word for word is basically this incarnation of truthfulness. You know, the ancient Greek scholars had an idea for this. It was the Logos. And it was, to them, it was this immaterial center for all truth. It was, you know, just like this thing that was there, and every true proposition was contained in it. And then the Hebrew scholars came along and said, yes, the Logos, but you're missing one thing. The Logos is from God. It's not this immaterial, or it's not this impersonal thing. And then John came on and he was like, all right, Greeks, you got it. Hebrews, you got a little bigger piece of it, but you're missing one thing. God is the Logos. He created everything. And then here's the kicker. The Word became flesh. That dwelt among us. So Jesus refers to himself as the incarnation of truth. That's pretty amazing. I mean, even Jesus refers to himself, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man can come to the Father but through me. There's no other figure in all of history that ever said that salvation is through him alone. That truth is through them alone. That in itself even stands puts Jesus set apart from everyone else. Also, what's the greatest commandment? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind. Man, I had to admonish this pastor who he was really well meaning, but he was preaching and he was talking about how, you know, if God's going to use you, he's going to use you, and you don't need to go to what he referred to as cemetery. And he was talking about seminary. And, you know, everyone laughed and stuff, and I was like, hey, would you go up to somebody, and would you even, you know, jokingly be like, man, you love God with all your heart? That is so dumb. I mean, would you ever even joke about someone loving God with all their heart? Well, of course not. Then why would you make fun of someone who's attempting to love God with all of their mind? That is the second greatest commandment. Or that's the greatest commandment, I'm sorry. So, you know, we don't mind making fun of people for loving Jesus with their mind, but man, we would never make fun of, like, oh, look at that guy. He loves Jesus with all of his heart. It's like, no, that's not the greatest commandment. It's to love it with your heart and with your mind. That's what Jesus said. There's a time coming, and time is when you must worship me in spirit and in truth. You must love him with your heart. You must love him with your mind. It's even funny, you know, this is a little rabbit trail, but you can see this in even various religions or various worldviews. People, like, you read New Testament scholars, and, you know, most of them are not Christians. And you read them, and they talk about evidence of the Bible like it was the War of 1812 or something like that. It's just this set of facts, and you can see that there's no heart in it. I mean, but they definitely love Jesus with their mind in the sense that they know these cognitive facts about Scripture. Then you look at some non-Christian cults or Islam. I mean, these people, I mean, it's, the hospitality of Muslims in Muslim countries, it would blow any concept of hospitality we have out of the water. You could easily make an argument that the majority of Muslims love Jesus with their heart. But the problem is, each of these in themselves doesn't mean anything. True spirituality is one of the Doc's sayings. I almost took it for myself. True spirituality is equal parts propositional truth and personal relationship. Or that time coming and time is when you must worship me in spirit and in truth. So that was number two, is that Christianity is anti-intellectual. And I'll say, you guys, listen, it is a sin to be anti-intellectual. So I don't agree that Christianity is anti-intellectual, but I think that there is a growing number of people within the church who don't care about loving Jesus with their mind. And, you know, I don't ever want to be, if somebody looks at me and they, I mean, I want to be a good scholar, but if someone ever looks at me and is like, man, that guy loves Jesus with all his mind, and that's about it, I would be crushed. But I want someone to look at me and be like, man, that guy loves Jesus with all his heart and with all of his mind. So you need both to have a proper level of spirituality. Number three, the third thing that they would say is that religion poisons everything. That's actually one of Christopher Hitchens' books, is God is Not Great, subtitle How Religion Poisons Everything. Now, one of the things that Dr. Fernandez says is, you know, I would agree with that statement as long as I can qualify it with false religion poisons everything. As we talked about before, I think reason will take us to true religion. And I think true religion will make us into be the light of the world, a city set on top of a hill. But false religion will poison everything. It will work its way in, and it will spread out and affect everything. And this kind of brings us into the point number four, is atheism. This is what they say: atheism is not a religion. And the reason I thought about combining those two, but I'm trying to keep my points fairly separated. But I would argue and say that atheism is a religion, and it is a false religion. Therefore, it's a poison. So why would I claim that atheism is a religion, even though if you say that to some of the new atheists or even any atheists today, they will get really mad and really fast. And there was one guy, this one time, this guy said to me, hey, is not collecting stamps a hobby? And I said, well, I don't think it is a hobby, but I don't think that's what's going on here. If you want to look at it as collecting stamps or not, I would say you're not just saying, I don't collect stamps, but you're also saying, you know, stamp collecting is for losers. Who collects stamps anymore? Or, oh, I would never collect stamps. I have a way better idea of collecting stamps. So it's not just about the participation in the event. It's the, I'm going to totally berate all those who would begin to participate in the event. Now, it is literally impossible to define religion as something apart from belief in God or gods. A lot of the times I'll ask these atheists, I was like, well, define religion. And they'll go off and, you know, say these various things, and I'll be like, I don't agree with that definition. I would definitely say that atheism is a religion. And they're just like, no, it's not, because we don't believe in a God. And I'll say, well, think about this. Would you consider Buddhist monks to be religious? Like, well, of course. They spend all their days in monasteries. They pray, do all these things. And I was like, well, Buddha himself was agnostic. He didn't think that the existence of God was that big of an issue. Conversely, most Buddhist monks today are either agnostic or atheist concerning the existence of God. But who is going to say that a monk who spends his whole life in a monastery praying and depriving himself, living this ascetic life, is not religious? I don't know of anyone that would say that. But he doesn't believe in a God. Not a lot of people know this, but the original Humanist Manifesto referred to secular humanism as a religion. Now, later that was changed because they wanted to invade themselves in the schools. And it's kind of difficult to get into a school if you're referring to your movement as a religion. It's like, no, wait, we don't mean that. We're not really a religion. We just said that in the original Humanist Manifesto, but we changed it. So, okay, we're good for schools now. Really, how the best way to define religion is what is most important to you. That's really the easiest way to do it. And then I would say a sidestep of that is what is most important to you and the beliefs surrounding why it's important to you. That is your religion and then your religious dogma. From that, it becomes pretty clear that atheism, in that sense, is a religion. You see the great lengths these people go to talk about, defend them, to defend their views. All right, number five, religion is unscientific. Ooh, that's a big one. We get that one a lot. How many of you guys have got that one before? You know, it's one of those things that it's almost like this is this phrase. You know, one of the things I said one time, this did not go over well, and I said, you know, do you realize that when you say it's science, that is as anti-intellectual as those Christians that try to just cut you off by saying, well, you just have to have faith. We just have to have faith. You know, the irony is, anytime someone says, you just have to have faith, they're usually saying that from a lack of faith. But it's come, so now that, you know, it's almost like calling shotgun. It's like, you know, you go outside and you're going to the car, someone's like, shotgun. And like, okay, well, that doesn't really, that means that, you know, that person should have, you know, the front. You guys know the rules of shotgun, right? You see the car and everything. But it's like this, it doesn't really mean anything. You know, like, let's say we're going outside. Let's say, well, Eric took us out for some food before this. And we're walking up and, you know, Doc says, hey, you want to sit in the front? Because, you know, you're a lot taller than me. And so almost like that, if we're walking outside with somebody and they call shotgun and I'm like, well, listen, I'm 6'4". I can't fit in a lot of people's back seats. And then I might say, you know, I'm feeling sick, so I like to be by the window. And I'm like, and I'm the navigator, so I want to be up front so I can see these things. And then they're like, but I call shotgun. That's kind of like what this unscientific thing is you're presenting all these views and you're like, oh, you know, what about this argument for the existence of God, and this argument for the existence of God, and this argument for the existence of God, and this argument for the existence of God? Yeah, but it's not scientific. Oh, it doesn't mean anything. You know, it's like, it's just become this catchphrase. I remember one time I was at Barnes & Noble, and I was chatting with this guy. I forget what it was, just something like basic. He saw me read my Bible. And so one of the things I like to do is, you know, I'm a huge people watcher. And I like to read my Bible in public and write and stuff, and then always get a chance to like strike up conversations with people. And I talked to this guy. It wasn't really very deep or anything, but this lady heard my conversation. And later, she was like, I heard your conversation. I was like, oh, cool. And she's like, about the Bible. I was like, oh, cool. What do you think about it? And then as soon as I started saying what, she's like, stop. I believe in science. I said, cool, me too. What does that mean? I believe in science. Okay, me too. What does that mean? It was like that was her end-all answer was, I believe in science. You know, I wrote this one paper this one time about proper understanding of theology and science. And I argued that it is impossible to have a fully functioning society without both. I mean, how many of you walked here? No, nobody? How many of you have indoor plumbing? Everyone. You know, there's so many aspects of our life that science allows us to flourish. But at the same time, science can't tell you that, you know, torturing babies for fun is evil. You know, you need theology as a proper way to understand very crucial aspects of the world around us. So really, if you want to have any consistent worldview, needs to be able to fully account for various scientific and theological aspects. And if you focus on one or the other, you're going to have problems. You're going to have either a science where you have no theology or philosophy behind it, so you don't even cannot create a comprehensive worldview, or you're going to be like, you know, the snake dancer people, and they're, you know, get bit by a snake and like, oh, I'm just going to pray for it. Like, oh, okay, you can do that, but I don't think that's very profitable. Okay, so one of the things too is, you know, Doc talks about this all the time. You know, the founders of modern science were Christians. You got three, I think, are fairly regularly not disputed. Is Kepler. He originated physical astronomy. Also has done some stuff with motion. Francis Bacon, he's the one who came up with the scientific method, or is usually credited with coming up with the scientific method. And Blaise Pascal, who is very famous, I mean, probably one of the most brilliant guys that ever lived. Famous philosopher, mathematician, all of them Christians. And in fact, it's interesting because not only were these guys Christians, but they utilized science as a means to worship their creator. They used, you know, like an artist would paint something. There's this one friend of mine, Promise Tangerman, or I forget her, she got married. But one of the things is on her business card, she's an artist, and she says on there, created to create. And she's an artist, and she looks at, every time I do artwork, I am worshiping the creator. I am worshiping my God. Well, that was the way these guys felt when they partook in science. Like, every time we know something about the world around us, we are, in a sense, knowing something about the natural revelation of God. And because of that knowledge, we are worshiping Him. So, the founders of modern science were not just theists, but were hardcore Christians. So right away, the whole idea of that religion or Christianity is unscientific, all of a sudden, not off to a very good start. One of the things that J.P. Moreland has said, he wrote a book, fantastic book. It's called Christianity and the Nature of Science. Great book. I recommend everyone read that. The first, 80 pages is basically him defining science. And he doesn't really ever define it because he realizes it's one of those things that really can't be defined. But his thesis is it's impossible to define Christianity as something that is, that it's impossible to define science as something that is totally devoid of religion or religious aspects. Very, very interesting. One of the things he said, or two of the things he said in class is one, if for the people that say, like, you know, intelligent design is not science or, you know, is not scientific, he's like, if that's the case, that then really science has only been going on for 100 years. If, you know, if ID is not science and only that stuff totally devoid of religious influence is science, then science has only been occurring for 100 years. I don't know anybody that would hold to that. You know, and that's the thing, too. And another thing he even points out on top of that is, you do not see any intellectually justified atheists until about the 1800s. Because until that point, there are some atheists and stuff, but you don't see them intellectually justified until much, much later. So, again, you have really no justification for claiming that religion is unscientific. Now, really what this comes down to is they say Christianity is unscientific due to Darwinian evolution. And usually what I do is, you know, there's one of two things you can do with this. You can either jump into Darwinian evolution, and that's a whole nother path. And the thing is, too, is you talk to someone long enough and you refute their thoughts, all of a sudden they're going to go back and they're going to get to the point and they're going to say, well, really what this comes down to is we go back further enough and we have to jump schools of thought from Darwinian evolution to abiogenesis. And abiogenesis is this idea of life can evolve from nothing. Life can be evolved from non-life. And I was like, wait a second, you're saying that my worldview is unscientific, and you have a whole field of science devoted to the idea of life coming from non-life. It's like, so this table can one day become, have life. Just wait, 1 second. It's going to happen. I know it. Nothing in our world tells us that life can come from non-life. So really everything, but anyway, so I don't even usually go down that train. I'll say this. If everything that Darwinian evolution claims is true, does that mean that it's impossible that God exists? They'll think about it for a while, and they're like, I guess not. I'm like, okay, then I'll grant you in the entirety of Darwinian evolution still has to deal with a creator. If Darwin himself was not an atheist, don't you think that maybe he didn't seem that he was justified in atheism because of Darwinian evolution? I mean, Darwin was an agnostic. He was not an atheist. So, even if everything in Darwinian evolution is true, it doesn't mean that God doesn't exist. Now, I think there's a lot of problems with that, but it's a lot easier sometimes to just circumvent these arguments than to deal with them straight on. One other thing I do want to say about this is there's this phrase, actually. This is the first teaching. When I teach my students at the Institute, this is the first phrase that I teach them. This is the best way I know how to teach anybody to begin a life of defending the faith or the apologetics. I'm going to teach it to you guys. It's not really Greek, but it's kind of like a very foreign statement. So I just bear with me. It's kind of difficult. But here it is. I don't know. That is your first step in becoming a fantastic apologist. I don't know. I was talking to this guy the other day. He asked me this question. I was like, shoot, I don't know. And he's like, I was like, what? I've never heard a pastor say that before. I'm like, well, I say it a lot. I usually, it was really cool. I've worked for it with 4 years straight, this group of guys. It started out with like 5 guys, and then some of them went to school, and it kind of got down to like 3 guys. But I was able to take these guys through all these different studies, and now they're all studying at the Institute. But, so many times I'd be like, I don't know, go ask Doc. I always just send people to Doc. But listen, we have to be able to say, I don't know. If you can't say that, then you are in no position to be a good scholar. Because what makes good scholars is not people that are born geniuses, but are people that, I don't know the answer to that, I'm going to seek the answer to that. It's like, growing up, my brother, one of the most phenomenal natural athletes I've ever come across. And I was focusing on all these different sports, and I was like, I really want to focus on basketball. So I focused on basketball, and I finally got to the point where I could beat my brother. And Joey said to me when I beat him, it's like, the only reason why he beat me is because you practice. What? Yeah, the only reason why Michael Jordan's in the NBA is because, put in 6 hours of practice every day. Well, who cares? If you want to be a good scholar, you have to start with this premise that I don't know and I need to seek the truth. Again, seeking the truth is a good thing because that's, you're seeking Jesus. I always tell my students, I was like, I don't like those Sunday school answers where everything, the answer is Jesus. I was like, oh, what's that? Oh, Jesus. Oh, I'm such a great teacher. All my students, they know all the right answer. But when it comes to truth, that's one of those things, like, truth is Jesus. That is correct. I'll tell you this little side note. We have absolutely nothing to fear from truth. There is no tidbit of truth or reality that you're going to tell someone, hey, wait, don't go down that road. You're not going to like what you see. The only time I ever caution somebody down a road of truth is in the occult. And I even, like, I told my mom, she was like, I'm really interested in about this stuff about, you know, like, occults and demons. And I was like, Mom, do not go down this road unless you feel God is calling you to a ministry where you're going to be, you know, ministering to people with who are demon-possessed and stuff. And she's like, okay, you know, whatever. And didn't really listen to me. And so she started reading about this stuff, and then she started having nightmares. And she was like, Matt, I'm having these, like, demonic nightmares. And I was like, well, did you start studying the occult? Yeah. Well, you should have listened to what I said. So that's the only thing I would say. Be very careful about getting into occultic studies. Besides that, never, ever discourage somebody from seeking truth. You know, never, ever discourage anybody from wanting to know more about a subject. Because there's never going to be, oh, I read this argument. I'm no longer a theist. You know, one of the things I'm going to talk about later is, as much as these guys claim, the new atheists, that they're these intellectual giants, most of the objections to theism are not logically based. They're usually very emotionally driven. Now, we still need to be able to give a reason for the hope that is in us. But, for the most part, it's not logically driven. Okay, number six, and this is going to be our last point. And then we'll jump to the next section. We're doing pretty good on time. So, and this is, religion is intolerant. Now, this is one of those words that doesn't really mean anything. It's like it's been used so many different ways. Like, even my friends, you know, it's like the worst thing in news if someone is called intolerant. And so me and my friends kind of jokingly say, you know, like, hey, can I have a quarter? I need to go, you know, buy a Dr. Pepper. I'm like, oh, I don't have a quarter. I'm like, you're intolerant! You know, just kind of throw it at each other. It doesn't really mean anything. And so all the time, oh, Christians are so intolerant. You know, one of the things I say is, the new atheists say that teaching kids Christianity is child abuse. That's something I've come across before. I even come across before. Now, this is pretty scary, is that Christianity is like an epidemic. That's literally, they use, you know, vaccine-type terminology when referring to it. And I was like, how could you be justified in saying that? And the guy says to me, well, what if there was this virus that affected how people lived, how people voted, how people spent their money? Don't you think that would be something like a virus? I was just like, wow. That's what your conclusion is, because Christianity can affect their worldview, is that it's viral in nature? But that's the kind of stuff that you're dealing with this new atheism. You know, I kind of, when I first started talking about this talk, I thought about bringing up all this stuff that would just, like, really shock and awe people, you know, stuff like that. But I realized, you know, shock and awe is good, but I'd rather, you know, equip you guys with some raw information. If you want to know other stories like that, I'll be happy to tell you. It was like 2 weeks ago, a guy called me pedophile. He was like, I was just giving these arguments for the existence of God. He was like, whatever. You're just another pedophile. Whoa, where did this come from? So, but I'm intolerant. So are you. I want to tell you a quick little story about Dr. Fernandez. And actually, you know what? I'm going to hold off on that one. If you guys want to hear it later, I want to make sure I get through to my question and answer period. Now, the last generation of atheist philosophers, I would probably say the three most significant were William Rowe, Michael Martin, and Anthony Flew. William Rowe, he wrote this really cool essay in this book called Contemporary Perspectives on Religious Epistemology. And it was edited by Doug Guyvet. And in this, William Rowe talks about some of the problems that theists have. And then he kind of concludes that there are these different types of atheism. And he concludes that the most profitable type of atheism is what he refers to as friendly atheism. And he says, listen, Christians can be intellectually justified. He said specifically because of the classical arguments for the existence of God. I'm going to talk about those in a little bit. But he's like, Christians can be intellectually justified in these things. So I think that we should say, yeah, I agree. I think the evidence is strong. I don't agree with you to the point where I'm going to believe that God exists. We're like, hey, that's great. That's, you know, actual definition of tolerance. Michael Martin, you know, he debated Dock. In their debate, it was in book form. At the beginning of every section, Michael Martin was like, you know, I'm so thankful to debate a scholar like Dr. Fernandez. You know, refers to him as a scholar, as a great thinker. Anthony Flew, and he debated Gary Habermas. He was a very, very gracious person. Very, would agree, is like, yeah, you are intellectually justified here, intellectually justified here. Now, the new atheists, they won't give you anything. You know, they will just straight up say, if you are a Christian, you're stupid. And that's literally, you know, what people have said, or what, you know, like Dawkins has said, that it's impossible to be a scholar, it's impossible to be a good thinker. You know, Anthony Flew, before he died, he actually became a deist. And when he became a deist, Richard Dawkins comes out and says, yeah, he used to be a good thinker. And I was like, well, you know, nothing in his thinking changed. You know, he continued to look at the evidence. The two main things that actually moved him to deism was, number one, intelligent design, was the mounting evidence for a designer in the universe, and two, Aristotelian cosmology. Basically, why is there something instead of nothing? But those two things, over time, he was like, I think there is a God. Does anybody know? This is kind of an obscure question. I don't even know if you know this, Doc, but do you know, like, what was the doctrine that really kept Anthony Flew away from Christianity? No, it was, according to Habermas, it was the existence of hell. So, and again, though, that's not really an intellectual problem. That's an emotional problem. Because you're saying, you know, how can, I don't like this idea of people suffering. And that's, now, granted, that is an intellectual problem. The existence of hell, you know, we need to deal with that on an intellectual level. But the way people question it now, it's definitely more emotionally driven than it is logically driven. So all these guys were very good scholars. I mean, we need more scholars like those guys. But, you know, the Four Horsemen is not in any sense. You know, when I first got my hands on Dawkins' book, I was like, oh, dude, I'm really excited. I want to go and I want to get in his argumentation. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm getting through and I've gone through most of the book and I was like, there's no argumentation here. The majority of the book is quotations of people saying religion is stupid. Like, that's your book? That's your great argumentation that religion is stupid? I mean, like, how does that in any way advocate your worldview? So that brings us to the point now of the second part of our talk, and this one is going to be really short, and then we're going to get into the practical aspect of it, is this idea of evidence. Now, Doc, you did your cumulative case this morning, or is that yesterday? Yesterday. How many of you were here for that? Okay, cool. And did you get into your preponderance of evidence? Okay. You know, I just want to briefly touch on this, is that the idea of evidence the idea of truth, evidence, and reality, I think, is our starting point. And the reason why I say this, and I even have gone so far to say, and people kind of didn't like that I said this, but I'll say it and I'll explain it, so don't, like, throw stones at me or something. But being able to defend truth is more important than preaching the gospel. And the reason why I say that is, I'm sure everyone in here has spent lots of time preaching the gospel to somebody, and then at the end they're like, yeah, that's true for you. I'm like, But if you take the time to talk about the nature of truth, the nature of evidence, and you set that up in a way where if they get to that point, they're not going to be able to say, well, that's true for you. They can't do it. It won't make sense. So that's why I say, you know, my apologetic methodology, if I have a serious amount of time to talk with somebody, I think they're the three most crucial doctrines in all of Christianity is truth exists and we can know it. God created all things. And Jesus Christ is God and was raised from the dead. That's where I focus all of my apologetics. Now, sometimes people ask me about Bible difficulties. I'll get into that, but I'm not going to get into those things with an atheist. And I'll explain that in a little bit. But I think that is going to be the most important place where we should go. Now, getting back to the preponderance of evidence, I think this is probably one of the more crucial matters. I think the best example of this we have is like the O.J. Simpson case. Now, look at the O.J. Simpson case, court of law. Did you talk about this? Yeah. So I'm not going to get into it, but in court of law, not guilty. Civil case, guilty. What changed? Did the evidence change? No. Witnesses changed? No. What changed? It wasn't beyond all reasonable doubt. It was, give me your evidence, and I'll give you my evidence, and if I'm at 51%, then, wow, I win. Now, I will take any worldview in the world, and I'll put it toe-to-toe with the Christian worldview. And I think that by far the Christian worldview will win out. It is by far, I argue it this way. If God is the most superior being in all of existence, then the lifestyle and worldview that he gives is going to be the most superior. Simple as that. And the last thing I want to say about evidence, or sorry, two more things I want to say about evidence, and I already kind of mentioned this, is most atheists are not so for intellectual reasons. And the reason why I say that is there's been a couple times where I'll sit down with someone, I'll go through my whole apologetic methodology, I'll start about the nature of truth, go into creation, go into the resurrection, and I'll be like, is there anything in my argumentation you didn't like? No. Is there anything you don't agree with? No, I agree with everything. Okay, so do you want to trust in Jesus Christ alone for salvation? No. But you just said I answered all of your intellectual questions. Yeah, you did. Knowledge is not enough. If knowledge is enough for someone to trust in Jesus Christ alone for salvation, the devil would be a Christian. He has better knowledge of God than all of us. Knowledge is insufficient. Knowledge and will. There could be someone that propositionally could defend the resurrection of Jesus better than you, but if he has not given his will, or she has not given her will, it doesn't matter. Like we were saying before, true spirituality is equal parts propositional truth and personal relationship. So, as much as the new atheists claim that that their move is intellectual and it's all these things, it's like no. The majority of atheist problems stem from usually was it Spengler? Who did the study on that? It was Spiegel. One of the things that he found was that two primary reasons for atheism was poor father figure and being burned by someone with a religious background. So that's one of the things that he found in his book on that subject. Okay, so after our brief little interlude just talking about evidence, I want to get to you, and we're going to finish up here. Finish up in about 15 minutes, and then that'll leave us the rest of the time for question and answer. But these are all things that people have asked me. Again, I'm trying to be as practical as possible, and then I'm going to give you my responses to them. All right, so number one, something someone has said to me is, there is no evidence for theism. How many of you have gotten something like that before? There's no evidence for the existence of God. Well, you know, I'm here. Might as well use the board, you know. One of the things I say is that any worldview, any worldview needs positive and negative arguments to back that up. Like, you know, if I'm going to say Seattle Seahawks are the best football team in the league, and someone would say why, it's like, well, they have a loud stadium, they have Pete Carroll, and he won these championships. You know, we have a great linebacking core. I mean, those are all positive arguments. And then someone might say, well, what about their weak in quarterback? Who's going to be their quarterback this year? And as I respond to that, that would be like a negative argument because I'm responding to some type of criticism. Atheism has really virtually no positive arguments for their case. There's three arguments a lot of time that claim to be positive arguments, but you look at them and they really don't hold. Most of the time they're going to be like, dude, I pushed too hard on this and I popped the thing in. So grab the other one. That's right, I'm a weightlifter, so I smashed it. You know, they'll say, look at all the wars religions have had. You know, they're intolerant, anti-scientific, you know, goes on and on. I'll tell you what, probably more than any worldview I know, atheists have the most negative arguments for their worldview, but they have almost zero positive. Really, if it comes down to, I would say maybe they have one, but the probably the three that they would claim to most is, number one, Darwinian evolution. Number two, the problem of evil. And number three, naturalism. Probably the one I would agree probably for the most as a positive argument would be the third one, and naturalism. But like we already talked about before, if everything they say about, if everything that is postulated by Darwinian evolution is true, still doesn't lead to atheism. So that's definitely out. Problem of evil. It was interesting. I read the study yesterday that atheists never die and atheists never suffer. Have you guys read that? Oh, no, wait. Evil is a problem equally for atheists as well. So that's not really, you can't really put that off on Christians. So now the problem of naturalism. And I think this is probably, if anything, the only positive argument for atheism. And, you know, that basic argument is this. If everything that we see or interact with in our world is natural, that would leave no room for a supernatural realm. Yeah, I think that is a decent argument. I think it's very limited. You know, even like one of my best friends, he's a naturalist, but he's a Christian too. Like, he only holds to physical existence, but at the same time, he still believes that God exists and that he's a Christian. So even then, in that sense, you have people who are physicalists and are still Christians. So really, that doesn't even hold up. So in the end, you have no positive arguments for the existence of God. Okay, so you've just said, I have no evidence for my worldview, but when I look at this, all of a sudden, you're like, oh, well, I don't fare much better. Now, Christianity. Who knows what the classical arguments are for the existence of God? I'm sure Doc talked to them. What? Not for the, well, yes, types of natural revelation. Like, well, that's not, I guess that actually is it, but that's not really a classical argument. But I think that is, you know, if you're, especially if you're an evidentialist like Gary Habermas, yeah, that's all. Gary Habermas, like, I'm going to get into like these philosophical debates. He doesn't even touch them. It's like, eh, doesn't matter. Yeah, teleological. Teleological or design. That's one. Cosmological, yep. And that's various creation types. Moral or axiological. And ontological. You know, if you really want to mess with an atheist, this is what I like to do this. And they think I'm like, you know, like speaking pig Latin. But they'll be like, there's no evidence for the existence of God. And I'll be like, really? I think that ontological, cosmological, teleological, and axiological is evidence. But you don't think so? Tell me why. Whoa! What are you talking about? Now, at the same time, though, too, and I think even too, yeah, I think definitely if you are, I always spell resurrection wrong, so I'm just going to be res. If you can fully defend resurrection, that's called the evidentialist apologetic methodology. That's all they focus on. Because the thing is, something could come out in cosmology that maybe we have to augment some of our arguments. Thing is resurrection is resurrection. You defend that, you're good. Two other ones I would say for probably main positive arguments are arguments from necessity. I can't spell that either, so I'm just going to scribble it so it looks like I spelled it. And then 7, I think this one is probably the least intellectual, but I think it's also the most powerful. That's one of Doc's sayings, too. I almost took that one for myself. Personal experience. I could say we could probably make a list of, 20 positive arguments for the existence of God. And even within this, several different types of cosmological arguments, several different types of teleological arguments, several different types of ontological. There's several different types of or axiological. There's several different types of ontological as well. So even on this list, we have 20 positive arguments for the existence of God. Yeah, but there's no evidence for the existence of God. Like, are you kidding me? It's like, no, we have an obscene amount of evidence for it. And not only that, we have negative arguments. So people say, well, you know, how could God allow evil or suffering? So, you know, we respond to it with an apology about, you know, the existence of God and evil. So on top of that, we have both positive and negative arguments. So when somebody says, you know, there are no, I'm going to talk about this a little bit more in my third question, I believe. But, you know, when people say that there's no evidence for the existence of God, I'm like, you're kind of out to lunch here. Because, and especially when I say that, it's like, you know, there's more positive arguments for the existence of God than there are for the atheistic worldview. And people are like, no, how dare you say that? People get really mad. I'm like, okay, well, tell me the positive arguments for the atheistic worldview. Religion starts wars. I'm like, that's a negative argument. Religion's intolerant. That's a negative argument. Give me views for your words. See, the thing is I'm gonna try, I'll draw here. This will be funny because, like, probably the only person here who's a worse drawer than me is Doc. Well, that I know of. But it's like this. I think this is another one of Doc's arguments too. I'm trying to remember, Doc. If I ever use any other ones that aren't yours, just shout at me. So it's like, don't try and figure it out. I'll tell you what it is. If you guys are looking at it now, and you're being like, what is this guy doing? Okay, these are two boats. Don't laugh. This is a theistic boat, and this is the atheistic boat. Now, the atheist here is shooting holes in the theistic boat. See those little holes there? It's draining. Well, I'll tell you this. Shooting holes in this boat is not going to make this one float. Atheists all day long try to point out, oh, Christianity has this problem. Theism has this problem. Has this problem. Okay, but you're still thinking. And the thing is, do you want to take the atheistic worldview and the Christian worldview and have them go toe-to-toe? Let's do it. I will put Christianity against any other worldview. And I guarantee you, Christian worldview will come out superior. But they like to say, well, you know, we're not a religion, or we don't have positive arguments. And I'm like, well, then you don't have a justified belief. Okay, next thing, I'm just going to briefly mention this one because there's some other ones that I think are more important to talk about, is a lot of times is I'll talk to people and I'm like, you know, and they'll say, well, I'm a skeptic. I'm like, cool. What type of skepticism? Well, I'm just, you know, I'm very skeptical of things. You know, I just, and I'm like, okay, well, you know, like, like, you question everything, and you're like, yeah, I want to know why I believe it. And so I was like, so what's your name? My name's Bob. Like, do you question your Bobness? What? I mean, do you question that you really are Bob? Well, no. I was like, hey, that watch, that's you, that's mine. No, it's mine. Well, have you questioned it's yours? All of a sudden, you start asking these questions, and all of a sudden, you realize, oh my gosh, there's like, see, once I start writing, now I want to like write everything. Like, wow, 99% of my whole life, I utilize almost no form of skepticism. And then the one thing I do use my skepticism on, what do you think it is? Theism. I'm a scholar now because I'm a skeptic. You know, actually, wait, I'll wait on that point. But yeah, it's so funny because almost every area of their life, they accept these things. And, you know, even these guys, they love Stephen Hawking. And they're like, oh, they talk about, oh, this guy's so brilliant. He goes off and says, well, the universe didn't need a cause because there were natural laws such as gravity, so you didn't need a cause. I was like, can we have gravity without matter? No, because that's how, you know, rocks, that's a rock. What is that? It's not a yo-yo. No, that's pretty bad. It's something falling. It's a widget, whatever that is. It's a widget falling. And, well, a widget can only fall because of the law of gravity and that it's matter. And so, really, there's so many both philosophical and even very natural law, a problem of natural laws with that statement. And all these guys are like, that's so brilliant. Like, where's your skepticism, brother? You know, it's like all of a sudden, like, oh, the guy's saying something that I agree with. Okay, I'm not a skeptic anymore. So this whole newer form of skepticism is not really skepticism. Okay, I got three more questions, or three more things that I deal with, and then I'll open it up for questions. This one I get, actually, a fair amount of time is, you're only a Christian because you're born in a Christian nation. Now, one of the things I love to say after that is, so you're saying this is a Christian nation? And they're like, no, we're not a Christian nation, but... And I'm like, no, it's either one or the other. You can't pick or choose. Either you're saying I'm only a Christian because I was born in a Christian nation, or we're not born in a Christian nation. You have to choose. And then they'll be like, shut up. But and what they'll say is, you know, Muslims are only Muslims because they're born in Muslim nations. So they said, had I been born in a Muslim nation, I would be a Muslim. And I was like, okay, that argumentation would work if there are no counterexamples. But if there's one counterexample, that's all it takes to say that it is not some type of necessity that if you are born into a certain religion, that's where you're going to be. And I had a Muslim guy talking to me about this once. He's like, you're only a Christian because you were born in a Christian nation. I was like, oh, interesting. So what about your prophet? What about Muhammad? Did he take on the religion of his fathers? He was like, I guess not. I was like, well, then there's your number one counterexample right away. So I'm not gonna belabor this one anymore. If you have any questions on that, we'll take it afterwards. Number four, this one I get a lot. There's this quotation by a guy named Stephen F. Roberts, and it goes like this. I contend that we are both atheists. I just believe in one fewer God than you do. When you understand why you dismiss all other possible gods, you will understand why I dismiss yours. So basically, he's saying is, I dismiss thousands of gods. You dismiss thousands of gods minus one. So we're both basically atheists. Now, if you figure out why I dismiss all these other gods, you'll know why I dismiss yours. I was like, well, and I'll go back to, and I'll say my occults, that's a really good way to say it, ontological, cosmological, teleological, my occults. I'll go through my occults. I'm like, this is the reason why I do all these gods. I say, you know, Zeus doesn't exist because he's not a necessary being. He doesn't exist because we don't have a moral argument for his existence. And I was like, the reason why I deny all these other gods is there's no evidence for it. Oh, there's no evidence for your God. Of course there is. We have all these occults. All these. Another one, I was talking, this happened 2 days ago. I was talking about the cosmological argument. And this guy goes, cosmological argument equally leads to the existence of Thor as it does God. I was like, you got to be kidding me. But no, seriously, you come across this a lot, is the arguments for God are equally bring you to Thor. And what I'll say is, all these pagan gods, you know, if you really even want to go there, let's say that they all did exist. Say every pagan god has ever existed. You know what? They're still contingent beings. There's no other I am that I am God in any of pagan mythology. There is no other great I am. So even if all those other gods did exist, none of them were self-existent. So let's say, okay, fine, they all existed. Say it. Zeus existed, whatever. Still contingent. If he's contingent, he must be contingent upon something. So that's an argument for the necessity of God's existence. And then one other thing, too, is I don't ever, you know, see, like, one of the things that Doc said in one of his debates is, like, I don't see you guys going after the Zeusites. You guys just like to go after Christians. But, you know, one of the things I say is there is no other contrived pagan, or there's no contrived pagan god that is going to use that god as an argument for his existence based on personal experience. Like, no one's going to say, I had a really rough time in my life. It was a dark time. Tell you what, if it wasn't for Darth Vader, I wouldn't be here. He shined his lightsaber in the darkness and lit my path, and I was able to... It's like, no! It's like you don't ever hear anything. What do you do hear people say, though? I trusted in Jesus Christ alone for salvation. And it transformed me. Five, I'm not going to talk about because Doc kind of covered this, is that there's no evidence that Jesus existed. This one is actually starting to become very popular. There's almost really no scholars that hold to it publicly. But, you know, I was talking to this one guy, and he's like, well, the Gospels, they weren't written for, I think he said 200 years after Jesus' death, which I don't know. And I don't even think Bob Price would claim it was 200 years. He'd be like, and he said to me, that's like somebody not writing about Barack Obama until the year 2200 AD. I was like, whoa, you're right. I was like, so you're basing your whole historical methodology on this. What do you mean? It's like, well, we don't have any writings about Alexander the Great for 500 years after his death. That'd be like not talking about Barack Obama to the year 2500. And then he kind of abandoned that argumentation very quickly. But actually, there's an obscene amount of evidence that Jesus existed. I suggest looking into Gary Habermas's book on the historical Jesus. There's great, great information in there. And then the last thing, and I constantly get this too, is people who say, I cannot believe in God because the Bible contains errors, or the Bible contains contradictions, or I cannot believe in God because of the existence of hell. And usually when I get those, you know, people say, how could you believe in God? God is immoral because he slaughtered these people in the Old Testament. Anytime I get questions like that, I say, whoa, stop right there. Someone says to me, I cannot believe in your God because he sends people to hell. And I stop and I say, listen, I'm a classical apologist. Classical apologists, their primary job is to defend the existence of God. You're talking about a very specific doctrine of a very specific religion. You're jumping the gun. Like, so I'll be like, are you conceding that God exists? And now you want to talk about the Bible? Like, no, I'm not conceding that God exists. I'm like, well, then let's go back to that question. We're not going to leave that unanswered. So what I do is I just circumvent it. You know, like some of my students, when I first get them, I have fun with them, and I'll ask them all these questions, and like, I don't know, and they'll try to answer them, and I'll say, why would you go into answering these questions? someone starts asking you all these severe contradictions, you just say, listen, until we establish the existence of God, none of these questions matter. So when people ask me about contradictions, ask me about errors and stuff like that, I'm like, well, none of that matters if God doesn't exist. So let's talk about the existence of God first. Once that has been established, then we can talk about all sorts of stuff like that. You can do like Habermas does, his minimal facts argument for the existence or for the resurrection. You know, he sets it up so you could believe that the Bible contains errors and you could still argue for the resurrection, because he only uses the evidence that the most critical scholars will allow. Well, in using the evidence the most critical scholars allow, it doesn't matter if the Bible contains 2% errors, 3% errors. He's only using what the most critical scholars will give them. So it doesn't even matter. Okay, so that's the end of what I had. I went a little, I'm still under. I got about 20 minutes left. But I wanted to save a half hour for questions. So it's not bad. Like 10 minutes over is not bad. So I'll leave it 20 minutes for questions. If there's anything you want me to go over again or clarify, or something that's maybe completely random, and it's just a random apologetic question, I'm just going to open up that time right now.
Well, first, thank you, Matt. That was awesome.
Yeah.
I agree with you 100% on your statement on the sin to be anti-intellectual.
Yeah. I would just say, look at Jesus. What did he say? He said that if you want to worship me, you must worship me with truth. Now he says, yeah, you got to worship me with spirit too, but he's like, you can't worship me. Could you imagine going up and saying to someone like, listen, you can't worship Jesus. What? Unless you're worshiping him with truth, you can't worship him. And that's something that especially, you know, it's so interesting how church age works and how denominations work. But I think denominations can be both very profitable and very hurting for the Christian kingdom. And so one of the ways they can be profitable is, you know, you have like more charismatic churches and they say, hey, listen, there's a God here called the Holy Spirit. You know, he's equally a part of the Trinity. You know, Baptists, you need to remember that. You know, and so they're good at emphasizing things that are being left out. Well, right now in our church age, we are emphasizing, you know, love Jesus with your heart. We need to make sure that we are reminding people that we need to love him with our mind as well. So that basically what I would say is, listen, it's not me saying this. I'm saying this is what Scripture says, is that, you know, true spirituality, you have to love Jesus with your mind. And anytime you say to somebody, oh, don't even think about truth, anytime a religious leader in your life says to turn off your mind, that would be a deal breaker there. I would leave that church immediately. Anytime somebody tells you, you know, the biggest problem I have with drugs and alcohol is that they can put you in a place where your mind is not your own. And one of the things that Doc always says is, if you put yourself in a place where your mind is empty, there are plenty of beings out there that are willing to fill it, and that's called demons. Now, I don't have, that's the biggest problem. I don't have a lot of the same arguments that people have against, you know, alcohol and stuff. But I think that is the biggest problem right there. It's the same problem I have with Eastern meditation. You know, Eastern meditation, emptying your mind, you know, through mantras and stuff. Well, if you empty your mind, you're just saying, you know, for rent, here, come and get it. So I would just say, you know, again, I was like, hey, don't kill the messenger. I was teaching a staff meeting at this church, and they're really into loving Jesus with their heart. And they're really into the Gospels. And all of their doctrines are kind of based on the Gospels. And I quoted Paul. And it was like, what? You quoted Paul? And it was like, you know, in Corinthians where Paul was saying, listen, those who are outside of the church, we don't judge those people. God judges those people. But those who are inside of the church, those are the people, yeah, we need to, with love, judge. Correct. And they, whoa, you know, they got very upset with that. And it was, well, what they got upset with was the language inside, outside. And they were like, well, how could you say those are inside, those are outside? And I was like, take it up with Paul. I didn't say it. So I would just go back to, I'm like, look at the scripture. I mean, Jesus makes it pretty clear he is the incarnation of truth. If you're against truth,